Okay, sorry about that. Okay, right, I think we've got the first slide covered. Chris muted me, so that was good. And he started the audio recording, so we're fine. Right, so as Chris said, we have a number of different things, lots of stuff of interest, I hope. And first of all, the member survey. I was looking at the comments, and one of them was essentially a question. But the problem is, of course, the survey is anonymous, so we don't know who sent anything. And so somebody wanted to go back and, quote, find older articles, sessions, but forgot where. So basically, this is a list of things in the club's archives. Articles would be things like software and hardware reviews. And if you go to the first link, you will find all the recent reviews plus a link to past reviews. Similarly, all the issues of the newsletter, the current to as far back as they go. In fact, I think we've got every newsletter is online except for the very first one. And we're not sure whether there was an issue number one. We never did find it. Anyway, that's available on the second link there. And then the Q&A sessions, there are basically two pages which are useful to go backwards. First of all, we have a list of all the topics, so you can search that page for a topic that's of interest. And then that will then link to a date, and that will take you to the QA recordings page, where all the files, the presentations, the audio recordings, and the text versions of the chat window are all posted for retrieval. And then for anything else that you want to know about the past history of the club, Jocelyn Dwyer's history page has a whole raft of stuff going as far back in time as the club exists. So if somebody on the call asked that question and I didn't cover what you were really after, then send us an email and we'll sort it out later on.
One thing worth pointing out there, too, is that on the homepage, there is a search box. And so if you plug it into there, it'll actually do a Google search on whatever you put in with site:opcug.ca. So if you're looking for a specific review or something like that, you might be able to find it quicker by doing the search box on the homepage.
Okay, all right, so thanks, Chris. So now we have a follow-up on the saga of various printer technologies, and Chris has got some notes on inkjets.
Yeah, so this came in from Bob Harris, some information, and so he has one of the Epson Eco Tanks, and so he really likes it. It's cartridge free, and you basically fill up these big bins of ink from bottles periodically, and they say that you should be able to get 18 to 24 months worth of ink. So he likes it, except when he doesn't print weekly. So what happens when you don't print weekly with an inkjet printer? They tend to clog up the print heads, and so the ink will dry up, and then you have to do a clean and flush or whatever the printer that you're using terms it to do the clean up the print heads, and it can waste an awful lot of that precious ink. Now, if you've got an eco tank, it's not overly expensive, but still it's wasting a lot of ink. And Bob had experience of it taking up to 30 minutes to actually do the cleanup. So better is to, if you have a task that'll print a page automatically weekly. And there was one link there on how to do it using Task Scheduler. And there was another idea from Tech Guy Labs, which is Leo Laporte, that he does a bunch of these podcasts and so forth. And so they talked a little bit about how to do that. So there are a couple of things on there if you wanted to schedule something or do something automatically once a week or so to print out. I had a little bit of an idea on this, and that one of the suggestions they had was printing out this big, huge pie chart with all kinds of colors on it. And I think that some of the solutions like that, yeah, you're going to get so that your inkjet heads are not clogging up, but you're going to waste a lot of ink on this test page that's of no use to you. So I think all you really need to do is pump a little bit of ink through the nozzles once a week. So why not just print four letters, CMYK, cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. And you can see from the graphic there that that matches up with the inks. So if you print out something that is cyan and it is printed in cyan color, it is obviously going to use that ink. So that, and then, so if you're pumping out from all four of the colors, so cyan, magenta, yellow, and black, and there's certainly enough paper coverage there that it's actually using all of the nozzles, I suggest that if you have 40 to 50 points, it'll make sure that all of the nozzles in the head get used, because it'll be with any print head that's going to be multiple passes across the page. If you have a printer that has more than four colors, and a lot of the professional printing printers do have more than four colors. I've seen them up to about 10 or 12 colors. If you do that, rather than just cyan, magenta, yellow, black, which may not use all of the inks, I suggest that you actually go and add additional colors that more or less match the colors of the other ink cartridges that you have in the printer. And if you need to, if you look to the cyan, magenta, and yellow, what the RGB values are. So cyan is green and blue, magenta is red and blue, and yellow is green and red. And so if you're, whatever you're printing from demands RGB values for colors, you can put those in. Otherwise, if it asks for cyan, magenta, yellow colors, you can put those in directly. So I would suggest if you have a test page that does that, and then schedule that to print once a week, or just a reminder on your calendar to print that once a week, then you probably will not have any cases where your ink heads jam up on you and you have to run that print cleaning cycle.
Okay, thank you, Chris. And next up, I have a short share on computer channels on YouTube. And there's basically three which I look at quite often. One is Linus Tech Tips, that's Linus Sebastian. And he's actually Canadian, he's based in Vancouver. And they have quite an extensive range of computer-related stuff that they cover. And Gary Explains is Gary Sims from Android Authority, but he explains a lot more than just Android-type stuff. And in fact, he had a little bit of a rant about Windows 11 and the fact that none of his seven PCs would run the new software. And then Explaining Computers is one I found fairly recently. It's run by a guy called Christopher Barnett, and he's a Brit. He speaks kind of slowly, but he really explains what he does. He really explains very well. So if it's a topic that's of interest, it's usually pretty good. Anyway, we'll come back to these three channels later on in the night. But first of all, I just want to say a little word about upgradable laptops. Now, the reason I mentioned the three channels is because Linus had a video recently on what he calls a completely upgradable laptop. And in fact, he liked it so much, you can see that he's actually put in an order for one of these things. So I was fascinated to find out what a completely upgradable laptop is. And it turns out it's made by a company called Framework. And it's three guys from the high-tech industry and put their heads together, three engineers, and came up with a design that is basically modular. So you can buy various versions of this thing. I'm showing you two different variants here. One's a base model with an i5 chip, about $1,300. And then if you go to an i7 chip and more memory and more storage, then you get up to more like $1,900. And there are various versions of this thing available and lots of kind of add-ons and customization that you can make. However, another interesting thing is that they also have what they call a DIY edition, something that you essentially build yourself. So the same laptop that you would buy for $1,299, if you buy the DIY edition, you save $300 because it now comes in just under $1,000. And it basically now comes in two boxes. One is the kind of main laptop, and the other box is full of bits and pieces and screws and all kinds of wonderful things. So, for example, the little square doodads there with the USB-type connector are actually modules, and there are various kind of modules that plug into this thing. And you notice the kind of pencil-like device down there, and Linus got all excited because he said, it even comes with a screwdriver. And, of course, he took the thing apart and was amazed to find that even things like the touchpad are screwed into the chassis. There's basically no glue in this thing. Everything kind of screws or plugs together. And quite an amazing little device. And the other neat thing is that every module in the system has a QR code on it. And if you scan the QR code, it will tell you how to repair it, where to buy the upgrade, and et cetera, et cetera. So it truly is quite modular and a very different kind of laptop if you're interested in buying an upgradable laptop. Anyway, that's the video is worth watching just to see how this thing fits together. So moving along, Chris has got a share on deleting files in Windows or recovering them or something like that.
Yeah, this actually was posted to the member forum by Alan, and I suggested that it would actually make a good share here at Q&A, so I threw together a few slides on it. So say you deleted a file and it's not in the recycle bin. What are your options? Well, you can recover from your backups, which, of course, all of us have good backups, but maybe it was created today, deleted today, and your backup ran last night, so maybe it won't be in your backups. You could use file history to get a previous version of the file, and of course we all use file history because that allows you near real-time recovery of files, and it'll keep pretty much endless, if you want it, versions of files that you have on your computer. So of course everybody's using file history, and if you haven't read about it, you can see an article that I've written in the newsletter about file history. You can find some free file recovery software, and there is some out there, or you could pay for file recovery software, which is usually a little bit more robust than the free stuff, but not necessarily. Or you could recreate the file from scratch, or you can use Windows File Recovery, which is an app that is available in the Windows Store. So you have to be on Windows 10 version 2004 or later, so that's just a little over a year old. So in terms of major releases, there's 2004 and 2009, 2009, and then there was 21H1 and 21H2. So the likelihood is that you're probably on that if you're running Windows 10. And to check it, you can go to Settings, System, and About, and it'll tell you the version you're on. Then you go to the Microsoft Store, and if you search for Windows File Recovery, it'll pop up, and all you have to do is click the Get button, and it'll install it onto your computer. Once it's installed, you run Windows File Recovery, and it actually runs as a command line application. So it'll open up a command window as administrator, and it will run the command itself, WinFR. And if you just run WinFR, basically the screen you get will be what you see there, which is just a little bit of a help screen. And so the basic help will tell you how you go about using the program. And it actually will tell you at the bottom of that screen where you can get the full user guide. So an example of how you might want to use it to recover a single file is you do WinFR is the command, and then you put in the source drive. So what disk drive is it on? So it's on drive C. and you put in a destination drive. So it's highly recommended that you put it onto a different drive so that you're not writing to the drive you're trying to recover from. So in this case, I'm going to recover it to drive E. You can actually specify a folder to put it into. If you don't, if you just put a drive letter, it'll actually create a folder called recovery_ followed by the date and time, and that's where it'll put the recovered file. Slash N is the switch to do a selective recovery. There are a couple of other switches, but that's the most useful one I find. And then you say what it is that you want to recover. So I'm on drive C, and what is it that I want to recover? Well, it's backslash users off the root, backslash and your username, backslash documents is your documents folder, and then backslash budget.docx. You can do things like star.docx. You can do all kinds of wildcarding, have it search your entire drive looking for deleted files, whatever. But this would be if you wanted to specify a specific file that was no longer there and that would recover it for. And there are tons more options, so take a look at the user guide, but very useful tool to have installed on your computer for when you need it. One thing I'll mention too that I didn't put on the slides is if you delete a file accidentally or whatever, do as little as possible on that computer until you do the recovery. So you don't want to be accidentally overwriting any area where that deleted file actually existed. Windows does a reasonably good job of not trying to reuse recent areas, but any actions that you take on that computer have the potential of overwriting where that document or file actually existed. So try to recover it as soon as you possibly can. And that's it for Windows File Recovery. I think it's a useful tool and something that everybody might find a use for at some point in time, and it's free.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And next up, we have another share on a tool. Well, this time it's an Android tool. And this is one that Stuart found. You want to talk about this, Stuart?
There we go. I'll try. I haven't tried this tool. I simply bookmarked it in my wish list as something to keep in mind, because I think it will be extremely useful for people who keep their Android devices past the upgrade dates. Essentially, it's taking the basic backup and restore functions that are buried in the system settings of Android and creating a separate application to do that that can be updated regularly through the Google Play Store rather than Google's system updates. So whenever your Android OS stops receiving updates, your backup service will stop receiving updates as well, unless you have this new data restore tool, which is made by Google, by the way. It's not some third party, hey, give me your data kind of scam. If anyone recalls, just last week I posted something in the users forum about different versions of Android, how many people are using different ones. I don't think any particular OS of Android has got more than 10% of the user market. So more than one of those flavors of Android is out of date.
I was surprised at the number of older versions that were still in use percentage-wise. It's a huge number of Android phones out there that are using out-of-date versions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think people become quite attached to their particular device. You know, they've got their fingerprints worn right into the edges of the thing, or they just like the size of it. Phones have become quite large over time. And, well, I don't know. I'm speculating, and I shouldn't do that. That usually goes off into Never Never Land. But this particular tool, if you're not, if you are going to keep your phone and don't care about the system updates any longer, and you want to be able to back up your data cleanly so that if you do get a new device and wish to simply type in however they do it, if you simply want to transfer all of your user data, settings, wallpaper, ringtones, bad jokes, whatever, to the new device, well, this tool from Google should allow you to do that without trouble. Should is the operative word here.
Still, the other thing about that is when Chris and I checked this out in the Play Store, it said that the app's already installed on your Android device.
Well, the software is installed in the system. I looked at it on the Play Store. The app has only been out. Well, I don't know how long it's been out. Not very long. But it says there's over 1 billion installs.
So I suspect they're counting the ones that were built into the OS.
Exactly. That's the inherent. That's the software inherent to the OS.
Yeah.
But that looks good on paper, too.
Yeah. That may never upgrade any of the versions that are built into the operating system unless you get, you know, an upgrade to the overall operating system. So this has the potential of providing an up-to-date version of that tool, even for older versions of the operating system.
Exactly. It's a bridge to a new device with less hiccups.
Yeah.
Unless you like hiccups. You know, that's a learning experience. Interestingly, Google's also doing something similar in the Chrome OS world. There's more and more Chromebooks and boxes out there that are past their end of life date and not receiving updates anymore. And there's some sort of software they're working on called LaCrosse, LaCrOS. And essentially what this is going to be is an updatable Chrome browser for a non-updatable Chrome OS device. Yeah, I know. What do I think? I think the idea is if people aren't going to get rid of their device, Google probably wants them to be as secure as possible. So just like COVID-19, their device isn't infecting everyone around them with stuff because it's not safe.
Well, there's a simple solution to that. Why don't they just give us updates to the operating system?
Yes. Well, my contacts at Google won't get back to me on that. Anyway, it's been a very quiet week. That's the only thing I found, and that's all I know.
Okay, thanks a lot, Stuart. That's good.
You're welcome.
All right, now we go on to something really exciting. We have a special feature.
And now for something completely different. So this I'll give a little bit of background first, and then we're going to have a poll. So we heard from some people that although the weekly Q&A running 7:30 to 8:30 was fine, they found that when we have Q&A following the general meeting, it runs 9 to 10, and that's kind of late for them to attend Q&A. They're getting tired and so forth. It perhaps was more of an issue when we were meeting in person, so people had to drive home afterwards. We tended to get very few people stick around for Q&A when we were meeting in person. We might have, you know, 5 or 10 people, and that was it. But even when it's on Zoom, I think some people do find it still to be a late night to stick around for 9 to 10 on meeting night for Q&A. And at some point, we are, in all likelihood, going to have, or there's a great possibility, we'll have in-person meetings again, and then it'll again make it an extra long night for people to stick around for Q&A who come out to the meeting, who then have to drive home after 10 o'clock. So we wanted to get a sense of whether people are willing to forego Q&A on regular meeting nights. The intention is to keep running them on other Wednesdays at 7:30, 8:30 as regular, like tonight, but just on meeting nights, which is the second Wednesday of the month, and just foregoing the Q&A on those nights. So I'm going to throw up a poll. It's anonymous. And let me find the right one. Okay, so we'll leave this on screen for a little while. So what we're trying to gauge is, if we go through it, what do you think about dropping Q&A on regular meeting nights only? So the second Wednesday of the month. So our regular meeting would run 7:30 till 9 o'clock as usual. And then rather than having a Q&A after that, we would just cut off the evening at that point in time. So, you know, take a look at the possible answers, weigh in. It is anonymous. And so we just want to gauge this idea of, you know, how much do people think that they can actually live with no Q&A. So I'll leave that poll up on the screen for a couple of minutes. And if anybody has any questions about it, by all means, chime in. If not, I think we can go on with the deck, and I'll leave the poll running for a little while, and then we'll look at the results.
Well, rather than do that, because the next one is fairly long, I think, Chris. So.
Oh, okay. So let's just leave
back to the chat, because there's a couple of things in the... Oh. Sorry, go on, Anna.
I just had a question on the poll. So it's not allowing me to check more than one.
No.
So the second one... It's confusing to me. I find Q&A so useful that I would prefer it to be every Wednesday, but I'm okay with dropping on regular meetings.
I mean, you really want to have, like, the first one says, you know, I don't want Q&A on that. Some people might say, well, I really would like Q&A, but if you really don't want to have it, then that's okay.
Well, that's a bad.
I know.
You told me I was going to be allowed to check more than one, and I can't, so that's fine. I'll submit one. Next time, you go to the survey expert.
This is not meant to be, a be-all and end-all
of
people's opinions. I just wanted to...
Long, confusing questions are a pain in the neck.
If we have the Q&A on meeting nights. I would like to suggest we have the Q&A on Zoom on non-Wednesdays.
Well, that can be a problem for people who do come out to the meeting if we have the in-person meetings again. So that would be problematic for those people who show up at meetings.
Why would it be problematic for them? Don't they have Zoom?
Not at the meeting.
That's true. But I'm saying... All I'm saying is maybe you've already assumed this, that the Q&A sessions will be, if they're not at the meeting, they will be on Zoom. That seems to be an assumption you're making. You're not going to have special meetings with Q&A.
No, not on meeting night. So on regular meeting nights, the second Wednesday of the month, we would just not have a Q&A session on that week of the month. That would be the option.
And on the other Wednesday nights, it would be on Zoom.
Yeah, yes, that's right. We would not have in-person Q&As ever. They would just be on Zoom, and they would only be on non-regular meeting nights. So 3 weeks of the month, we would end up having it on Zoom.
Okay.
Okay, I think it's slowed down there in terms of the responses. We have 22 of 28 voted. I'm just assuming the other ones have decided not to vote. So I think we'll end the polling there, and I will share the results. So does everybody see the results screen?
I believe so.
Okay, so it looks like 57% are okay if we just drop Q&A on regular meetings. Some people would prefer that we actually do keep it going, but they'd be okay if we just drop it. So they're not that married to it. They really want it no matter what is 17% or 4 people, and no preference 3 or 13 people. And nobody who wants to commit to having a share for every regular meeting night that they want Q&A so badly. That was a little bit of a humorous add-on, by the way, if anybody's wondering. So we'll take this under advisement, but I think that based on this and based on some of the feedback that we've gotten on the idea that regular meeting nights, it gets kind of late, I think we might be aiming towards the idea that regular meeting nights, we will not have Q&A anymore on those nights. But there's still lots of opportunities for people for Q&A on Wednesday nights that are not meeting nights. So Alan and I will talk about that, and we'll come back next week with what we've decided that we'll do on that.
There's also the email forum for asking questions at any time, getting answers even sooner.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. So I will stop sharing the results, and we'll carry on. Alan.
Okay. Sorry. I'm sitting on my screen. I guess I have to pause it. Right, so there were a couple of things in the chat I thought we might touch on. Eldon's asking, this is a page of archive links. Could this page be attached to our home page for future reference? And I believe Bridget's on the call, so our webmaster can take that under consideration. Bill suggested, in terms of test pages, have Alexa remind you to print off a test page once a week. Micheline asks, does the customizable laptop company have a customizable desktop? And the answer, Micheline, is no. Right now, it's a brand new company. They've only just started taking orders, and they're only offering either the pre-built laptop or the DIY edition. So the only laptops available at the moment. Tom is saying that most laptops can upgrade WIRI, should that be Wi-Fi maybe? Memory, NVMe, SSD, fairly easily, even Apple.
That's true, but if you look at the website for the framework computer, I mean, you can even upgrade the ports that you have on. If you decide you wanted, you know, HDMI instead of DisplayPort, or you want USB Type-C instead of USB Type-A, you can upgrade the battery, which a lot of laptops nowadays, it's not all that easy to upgrade the battery. You can upgrade the screen or replace the screen easily yourself. Things like that. So it's really, really modular.
And not only do you get a screwdriver, but you get a white and a black bezel for your screen.
Yeah.
Ooh. And Natalie had some stuff on.
Yeah, she mentioned. She mentioned afterwards that it was an ESUS mid-year sale info, and she didn't mean to send that to everyone. So.
Oh, well, of course not. You can always check the current prices.
Yeah.
And Tom's saying that most laptops can upgrade. Lawrence is taking exception, especially with respect to Dell and the Lenovo Carbon X series. Great machines, but some of the stuff isn't upgradable, which is a huge problem.
Yeah.
Tom says SanDisk flash memory comes with a code for Rescue Pro software, and he's got some if anybody needs one.
And I have been told by our survey expert that.
There you go.
I'm sure I'll hear more about that later.
Okay, so back to the deck, and we're on to our question about creating links.
Yeah, so this came in, a question about linking to directories. So it was commented that the music folder, pictures, and videos, or some version previous on Windows, it was My Music, My Pictures, My Videos, and that. They're just links to actual directories that exist somewhere in the system. So as an example, I point to my File Explorer, and under this PC, there is Documents. Well, that's actually a pointer to /users/ my username and Documents. So the person wanted to know, how can I create links in one directory that open up in another directory, or actually create files or whatever in that other directory. So The answer is symbolic links. So symbolic links allow you to create a link to another location. So an example I have here is where /users/your username/documents/old files would actually access a folder called previous files under data on your D drive. And so to set this up, what you have to do is make sure that what you're linking from doesn't exist. We're going to create that in the next step. So you make sure that /C users/username/documents/old files, that old files folder does not exist. You make sure that the destination does exist. So in this case, it's D:/data/previous files. So once you've got the file directories set up, what you want to link from and to, then you go on to actually create the symbolic link. To do that, you open up a command prompt as the administrator. So the easiest way, if you don't have a shortcut for it, you click on the start button, you just type in CMD. In the results, you will see at the top will be command prompt. You right-click on that and choose run as administrator. Then what you do is you type in mklink/D, and D is to do a symbolic link for a directory. There are some other ones you can do as well. You can actually have a symbolic link for a file as well, but we're going to do it as a directory. Then you say what your source is going to be. So in this case, it's C:/users/username/documents/old files. And again, old files cannot exist already. And then what do you want it to link to? And this does have to exist, D:/data/previous files. You put that in, you hit enter, and you'll get that result. It'll say symbolic link created for the source, and then you got the double-headed arrows because it is actually a two-way link to the D data previous files. So now what you have is you'll see what looks like old files as a directory, but it's not actually a directory, it's a shortcut, okay? It's a shortcut or a pointer to D:/previous files, data previous files. So anything you create within that, it acts just like a folder. So you can go with File Manager or whatever application you want, you create a file or modify a file or delete a file that is within C:/username/documents/old files. So you create one called, you know, my budget or whatever. That file will actually get created in D:/data/previous files. If you delete a file that exists in that old files, it'll actually delete it from the D:/data/previous files. So it really is just a pointer to that other location. Now, if you actually delete the folder itself, C:/users/username/documents/old files, all your files will remain on drive D because all you have is it's a shortcut to the other folder. And so it'll just delete that shortcut and your files will actually remain on there. So that's an easy way to do it. There is, as I mentioned, there are ways of linking individual files. That can be useful if you have something like a single file that you want to appear in multiple locations. What you can do is you can create a symbolic link to the file so that it appears in as many locations as you want. You can access it in any of those locations, and it'll actually just be a pointer to the other location. So that's my suggestion. Tom had a comment on there that hard links are useful to reduce data use by just having links to duplicate data. That can be done as well. You can also do it as a symbolic link to a file. Actually works as well. Symbolic links can be between disks. I think that's a limitation of hard links, if I'm not mistaken. Tom says that a hard link has to be on the same disk, whereas symbolic links can actually be between complete file systems. Can be different. And he says that I think it works with directories. So, yeah. So a further question in amongst that same batch was linking to a web page. So the person wanted to know, how do I create a link in a directory or folder on your computer that opens up a specific web page? And there's two ways that I knew of to do it. The first one is create a shortcut. So you can create it manually by going right-click in the destination. So whether it's in whatever folder you want that shortcut to appear in, if you right-click and choose New, there'll be an option for shortcut. And then you basically just type in the URL. So in this case, I typed in https://opcug.ca. When you click Next, it'll ask you for a name for the shortcut. And so I entered in the name of OPCUG website. And then you click on Finish, and you end up with a shortcut in that folder. You double-click on that. It'll open up your default browser and take you to that particular website. Another way I know of taking care of the option is to actually browse to the website, and then in the browser window, once you're at the right site, if you left-click on the lock that is beside the URL and drag that, you can drag it to a folder, drop it there, and it'll actually create that shortcut for you. So it'll act exactly the same as the manually created one. It's just another way of creating that that shortcut. And I think Alan has some ideas going beyond that.
Yeah, I actually use this technique quite a bit. You could create one link to a website using this, but it's much more useful if you have a number of different web pages that you access regularly and you need an easy way to get to it. Of course, you can do that with bookmarks and so on. But what I do, I like to use a local HTML file. And then I add the links and I basically create a simple menu. So if you remember when we were talking about the YouTube computer channels and the Linus Tech Tips and so on, you can see here in the browser, I've actually got links to those three different things. So basically what I've done is I've created an HTML file on my disk, and it has a few HTML commands, and it looks kind of complicated, but it really isn't. We're only using a few HTML tags here, and we can go through it fairly easily. You basically need to tell the browser that this is an HTML file. So you're creating a text file, and you use a tag, HTML, in between these angle brackets is what they call a tag. And typically tags occur in pairs. So you have an HTML and a slash HTML. And that says open an HTML file and close the HTML file or the code. I say almost always it occurs in pairs because there are a couple of tags that don't. And one of them is the image tag. If you wanted to use an image, then you don't actually need a closing tag on an image command. And, but we're not going to use images, so for our purposes, tags always do occur in pairs. So we set up our HTML code. And now what we need is we need some header information. So we need a head tag and a slash head to close that. And then in between those header tags, we're going to use a title. So we use a title and a slash title, a pair of tags here. And then in between that, whatever text we type, and I put in YouTube computer channels, that text will appear in the header of the web page on the browser. And you'll see that later on. So the next thing we want to do is the main event, the body of the HTML code. So we use the body tags. And then in between that, we actually want the working end of things. And what we're going to use is a set of anchor tags. And anchor tags are this A/A pair. But then in addition to that, we use what's called an href attribute. An href is a hypertext reference. And basically the href goes inside the open anchor tag. And it uses the format href equals, and then the actual URL, the link, we put inside these quotes. And then what we have, like the title tag, the text that we have between the anchor tags is actually what will be displayed on the screen. So you can see here, I've got the actual URL to Linus's YouTube channel, but I'm going to display Linus Tech Tips on the screen, And so I'm going to be clicking on Linus Tech Tips, and it's going to be taking me to this URL. Now, clearly, I could just add three of those things, but it's better if I space them out a little bit. And what I tend to do is use a paragraph tag, just a letter P inside the angle brackets. And interestingly, you don't need the, you can use the pair of tags, but for a paragraph, you don't need the closing tag. So I tend to leave it off. So my final file ends up with an anchor tag to Linus, a new paragraph, so get a blank line, and then an anchor tag to Gary Explains, and so on and so forth. And then I just save that as an HTML file with an extension .htm. And you can see here, that's a simple text file. I've created it inside Notepad++. And Notepad++ is neat because it knows about HTML code, so it color codes things for us. So you can see the HTML tags are all shown in blue, and the links are in purple, the href attribute is in red, and the actual text is in black. And there's also some indication here about opening and closing tags in the left margin there. So sure enough, here is my web browser. There is the title, YouTube Computer Channels. Here are the three text strings which I'm using to link. And if I click on Linus Tech Tips, then it will open up this URL to his YouTube channel. If you really like HTML, you can get a bit more complicated. Here's my page of computer, mostly computer websites that I use a lot. And if you look over here, you can see that there's a link to the PC User Group website. There's a direct link to Google Groups and the members forum and so forth, and various other things. And you notice this is done in a table format. So I've got three different columns and titles spanning three columns and so on. And to do that, you need to know a few more HTML tags. And one of the ways to do that is to look at this file, which is a presentation I gave to the club a number of years ago about how to program or how to code in HTML. HTML is hypertext markup language. So it's not really programming. It's really marking up a text file using specific formats that browsers understand so that they display the various attributes that you're trying to capture correctly. So it's actually a really easy way to create simple menus, which you can use in your browser to access multiple web pages all at once. Okay, and that's it for tags and shares and things. So we have about 10 minutes. I don't know if anything was in the chat window there, Chris.
Tom pasted in some links to Udemy, which has some free courses available. So if you're interested in those, they're all free video plus courses for a few days. So if you're interested, go and sign up for those. My understanding is once you signed up for it, you don't have to take them immediately. You can postpone the actual running of the courses, but you do have to get signed up soon if you want it for free, my understanding. And Bob Gallen
is saying that he's taken quite a few courses and they're really good value when they're on sale. That would be the paid ones, of course.
Yeah. Very good value when they're free.
Yeah. But they're great value when they're on sale too.
Yeah.
Okay. So any other questions or things that people would like to share?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
I'd like to set up some privileged programs, in particular, I guess one is Hardware Info and another is HD Sentinel. They need to be run as an administrator, but I'd like them to start up sometime after I log on. How can I set up a scheduled task to do that, to run as an administrator and still have the icons I'd like in my taskbar.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because I think if they run as administrator from scheduler, usually they run as a hidden task. I thought. I'm not 100% sure of that. Did you try, because in task scheduler, there is an option to run as administrator, right? Or a specific account.
And well, you can run, I've tried it. You can, there is a separate thing for putting in permissions, but it doesn't seem to show up in the taskbar.
Yeah. Did you try running it as system? It probably will do the same, but just on the off chance. Now, I think that actually runs hidden as well, because that's one of the tricks of if you have a scheduled task that you don't want to appear, if you run it as system, it doesn't appear. So you want it to actually appear. That's interesting. I don't know. Anybody else have an idea on using task scheduler to do that? Just while we're talking here, I'll just take a look at it and see. I haven't done an awful lot in task scheduler, but so they have, run whether users logged in or not. There is an option there for run with highest privileges. Do you know if that, did you try that? And
That's what I tried.
Okay.
And I haven't gotten the taskbar. The windows are things like temperature readings and other stuff like that. How fast my computer is going, the temperature of the disks, and so on. And that's why I do it.
Now, did you try actually, rather than highest privileges, did you try running it as system?
I've not tried running it as system.
Oh, okay. Let me share my screen, and I'll just show you if I can find the controls for Zoom. Where are we now? Okay, so if I share screen, and I'm going to share task scheduler. Okay, so when you're in task scheduler, if you come in to create a task, and then this is what you have tried, I assume, is this. This is interesting. I can't seem to get my pointer to come up. A second. Oh, there we go. Okay. My pointer isn't going to show up. That's because I'm only sharing a window. So that is the run as highest privileges, but you can also come into where it says change user or group. And if you just type in here system and say check names, then it'll underline it. And then if you click on OK, it comes back and it says NT authority /system. So try that, but I'm pretty sure that that will ensure that it runs hidden as opposed to appearing on your taskbar. I don't think. Yeah, this box at the bottom for hidden, checked or unchecked, I don't think that that will actually help you at all in this regard either. Yeah, that's an intriguing one.
Yeah, I'm having to use Wind Patrol, which is an old program that does some things. It's now obsolete. I think the guy retired and the successor is also seems to have left the internet.
Okay. Actually, I have an idea of something else that might work is if you create a shortcut, you can create a shortcut that will run something as administrator, right? I'm pretty sure you can. Just a second, let me just see if I can. If I create a shortcut, new shortcut, and then if I just have, let me just try Notepad or something like that. And then next, Notepad. Now, where did that create it? Oh, crap. I just think that there is a way.
Well, I'll try out shortcut. I'm thinking, a shortcut. Yeah,
well, let me see, because if I go on advanced. Yes, okay. So once you create a shortcut to something, then you can right-click on the shortcut, and then go to properties, and under the advanced button, there is an option to run as administrator. Then what you might be able to do is create a scheduled task that runs the shortcut.
Yeah. I know, one step after another after another.
Yeah. And
well, you get up the mountain.
Yeah, I presume that that would work, though. So
I'll try it.
Yeah. Yeah, let us know. I'll play around a little bit, too, if it see if I can get things to work. But I think that that's probably your most straightforward way of getting it to work. Anybody else have an idea? Okay.
There's another question in the chat there, Chris. When printing CMYK, does it matter if the print mode is draft better or best quality?
I don't think it really matters. You're just trying to use a little bit of ink. So in actual fact, draft mode is probably the best. You know, you're just trying to spit out a little bit of ink. So I suspect that draft would be fine.
And you could probably cut off the top of the paper, making it shorter and shorter until it becomes too short.
True.
Okay, any other questions? If not, I'm just going to... Oh, there's one from a comment from Stefan.
Why not put the command in Roman startup menu, startup? Yeah, you could do that as well. It's going to start at startup, though, and I think, Tom, you wanted it to start up a period of time after you started the computer?
Startup would be fine, but the problem is that then it asks me for the administrator password each time.
Oh, yeah.
The point is to try to start it as an administrator and not have to enter the password. So that's my my two objectives are not having to enter the password and then having the little bubbles appear on my taskbar, which currently have, seems like about 30 of them. I'm going to hate the new taskbar in Windows 11 when it comes around because horizontal and on the bottom, my 40 bubbles are going to struggle.
Yeah, and as I understand it, with Windows 11, at least currently, you can't move the taskbar. You can make the icons on the left rather than centered, but you can't move the taskbar to the sides or the top of the screen.
Yeah, I have had mine on the side for ages. Yeah. I always use tree style tabs in the browsers, or at least in Facebook, and I think you can also do it in Chrome natively. You can move the tab bar to the left so that you can actually see the names of 50 or 60 tabs there instead of having tabs across the top where it gets really messy. It's all in one row on the left.
Yeah, Edge can do that now too. Edge can have vertical tabs. I tried it for a while. I hated it.
We'll let Chris and Tom fight over who can figure out how to do that process, and we'll have a follow-up next week from one of you. So next week is our next Q&A session, August the 11th. If you have any questions or things you want to share before then, send us an email to our suggestion box, and we'll be sure to include it in next week's deck. So thanks very much for attending tonight. And good night for me.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, everybody.